Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, July 18th. We start with the latest on funding for public media. It has been zeroed out. Governor Josh Green gives us an update on the efforts to reconstitute the Hawaii Tourism Authority Board, a board with less power and less money for marketing. We hear from the first Hawaii recipient of a Global Marketing Award for shopping centers. And we take a closer look at a summer program focused on getting more students into the STEM fields, science and technology, with culture woven in. Plus, taiko master Kenny Endo celebrates 50 years of the Japanese art of drumming. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. First up, the latest news about funding for public media. HPR News Director Bill Dorman joins us this morning. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Aloha, Catherine. So Congress has done it. They passed the Rescission Act, and that means more than $1 billion is being cut from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is unprecedented. We've heard it all morning, but it's true. We're going to feel that here at HPR as well. In our latest budget, we got more than $500,000 from CPB. But the overall price tag to HPR of this change is likely to be higher. We don't yet know all the additional costs that may come as part of this. NPR may raise some prices on programming, impacts of other stations perhaps falling out of the public radio system. There's a lot of uncertainty right now. So we're going to go on the air with a two-day drive next week, the Protect HPR fundraising campaign, Wednesday and Thursday. Going to be focused, minimally disruptive to programming, but underlining the seriousness of the situation. This is not just another pledge drive. It's pretty remarkable time. You can find out more information at hawaiipublicradio.org, including an updated note from our CEO, Meredith Artley, and definitely we'll have more information to come next week as well.
All right. We certainly appreciate you tracking this, but thanks so much, Bill.
You bet. Thanks.
You know, earlier this morning, we connected with Governor Josh Green to get us up to date on reconstituting the new advisory board for the Hawaii Tourism Authority. The visitor industry is our number one economic driver, and the recent infighting on the previous board was not productive. Here's Green.
Applications are coming in and are being reviewed. There's no deadline specifically when this board has to be re-impaneled, but the legislature did the right thing by making HTA an advisory board to me, and I just wanted a clean slate. There had been some kind of conflict going on, and we have to be on the same page. So per the state law, the HTA board members are going to be appointed by me. One will come from the Senate and one will come from the House also as recommendations. So they will recommend someone and then it's going to be a go. But I really wanted everyone to be working together because though tourism has been stable and revenues are slightly up, it still is evident when we're fighting. And in my administration, I want everybody working in the same direction. The metaphor is all paddling together in the same direction, and that's got to happen. So we'll have a new board. They will continue to make sure Hawaii is a special place to be, and we'll continue our ideology of supporting tourism, but also maintaining a very strong cultural sense of what we're doing and making sure that we are aware of any potential for over-tourism.
And do we know yet how many of the candidates who were interested in the HTA executive director job are still in the running or still interested because things have changed since they first put their applications in?
There are a lot of people that were interested, right? And it's going to be important that this new advisory board take a good hard look at those who have applied and really what they feel the future should be for the executive director. Again, it's got to be someone that I can work very closely with. It has to be someone who understands where we've been, which was going through tough times as we sorted out the early contract differences when I first was elected governor. We worked through that, which HBCB and CNHA, all very good people, but I really want us to move forward. And we are emphasizing some new things. I've decided with the DBED director, with Jimmy Tokioka, that we're going to emphasize things like film, cultural film, as far as how we express ourselves and are seen by the world. Tonight's a special event because we're going to have Chief of War be screened here. And I would like to see movies and shows like that here, which also doubles our efforts in putting the right face on Hawaii. Also sports tourism. We have overtures from several NFL teams now that I've invited the Los Angeles Rams to do their camps here on Maui. And that helps us recover too. So there's a lot of new emphasis. And when I talk to the new applicants for the board, I'm going to make sure they're on that page and have good ideas. And then the new director is going to have to be just a person that can work seamlessly with them. So a lot of work ahead, but this was one of those sticky situations where I was starting to get frustrated that they weren't working well enough together. Good people, but they weren't all on the same page.
I am hearing calls for, let's say, some promotion from the folks that are down in Chinatown. They're saying, oh, will we see any of that HTA money come our way just to help provide another place for the visitors to go if they aren't already poking around in that part of town?
For sure. And I live on the edge of Chinatown. And though I'm not a tourist attraction, I'm very aware of what they need down there. And so I think that's an absolute. When I put the panel together, I'll make sure there's Neighbor Island representation, there's representation from different cultural perspectives. It's a unique thing to be putting an entire board together. I'm excited to do it, honestly. It's just they're going to have to be likable, friendly folk that all like each other. Because I think probably 2/3 of the meetings were spent on battles internally. And that's just not okay. That would have been time well spent on, yes, promoting Chinatown, setting up contracts to support it, all the neighbor islands, which had slightly softer numbers because travel from abroad is down. The Canadians need to be supported a little bit who haven't been invited to the United States very delicately in the last few months when the president talked about taking over their country. Things like that I still have to deal with. And also we have the ever-present need to focus on Japan and the recovery after the COVID pandemic when travelers from Japan hold up back in their country. So there's just so much to do, but I want to set a new standard for how we market ourselves, and that is going to include very positive, dynamic things. I'd love to have some film shot in Chinatown, for instance. There's cool stuff on the horizon, I'm sure, and I will panel these folks in the coming months.
Are you worried that there may be candidates that you ask that may not want to serve on this board because they see it with less power and, quite honestly, less money?
No, I will tell them, look, only volunteer if you want to be a part of it. So I will have a large number of names. I've had a lot of people reaching out to me, honestly. And because it's a little bit less formal, I think in a strange way that makes it easier. A lot of the advisory councils and boards and commissions, people are a little reticent if they have to sometimes go in front of the Senate, which can on occasion be rough. Also, these are volunteer boards. They pay nothing. And they take a lot of time, and also people need to show all of their personal financials, and that's just a bridge too far for some people. I understand that not everyone's going to want to serve, and service is not for everybody. But in this particular area, there's a lot of dynamic work that needs to be done, and so there's a lot of people from different industries in tourism, parts of the industry, that are eager to get on it. So I'm going to make sure it's people that I know well. I'm not going to put people on there that I just don't have a relationship with at all, because I don't want any surprises.
And Governor, this week we saw the headlines about Hawaiian Air Alaska laying off a couple hundred employees. Any concerns about that?
Always. I always have a concern when anyone gets laid off. A couple things. All the union jobs are protected, which I insisted on. They're going to be hiring 800 people over the next year also, including pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, various other roles at the airport. So it's going to be a vibrant job market for those working for Hawaiian Alaska Airlines. But I never like to see anyone lose their jobs. And I will tell people, depending on what their area of interest is, if they're an admin or whatever, we, you know, at the state are looking for people. And we're providing very good benefits. I've been increasing salaries quite steadily. And so if it suited people, I hope that they will go over to our DHERD website. We still have the heavy push we're doing to hire federal employees that have gotten laid off that have connections to Hawaii. That's Operation Hire Hawaii. But I would be honored to also welcome any former employees of Hawaiian Airlines. They should look at the Department of Transportation. And I know that Ed Sniffen, who's a really strong member of my cabinet, is always looking to hire people. They usually have about a 30% vacancy rate. So that's another option for people. We have essentially the lowest unemployment rate in the country, and there are a lot of jobs around. But I do feel for anyone who ends up getting laid off, that hurt.
We did talk to Ed last week. We were focused on airports and customer satisfaction. And I know when I touched down in New Orleans, I heard an announcement from the mayor of New Orleans welcoming travelers to the city. And when I inquired about doing something similar here, they said, oh, there's a program in works, possibly with you.
Yeah, it's possible. I'm a little bit worried about, I'm just not comfortable with any self-promotion, honestly. So sometimes that is an issue. But I do welcome people, and I like to get out, but just in a more organic way. I do also want people to know that we're grateful when they travel here. And there are some things that we've been making sure they're clear about, which is really what it means to travel in Hawaii and to be careful about the aina. Also, there will be a time for us to message as partners the value that they're adding on our climate impact fee, because though some people thought it would be controversial, it's turning out to be a collaboration between travelers and our state to preserve and protect our environment. So I want to be able to thank them for what they do. And also, that's a way to subtly remind people to be careful when they're on the reef or near the extraordinary species that exist only here and are quite fragile in some cases. So there will be some of those messages, but I don't want it to be too heavy-handed, because I've walked into some of these airports where, you know, you see the mayor or the governor's face everywhere, and it's like Big Brother. So let's welcome them, but not overdo it.
And we will hear more from the governor coming up. He plans to meet with key members of President Donald Trump's cabinet at an upcoming meeting of governors. Let's get back to our conversation with Governor Josh Green. With the new school year just weeks away, some families were nervous about the headlines of possible loss of funds impacting school campuses. The A-plus after-school program is not affected, but we asked the governor about the low vaccination rates as students return to the classroom.
Across the country, there's been some vaccine hesitancy, and when vaccines drop under 95% in schools, there can be outbreaks, and when they're under 90%, there's a high probability of outbreaks. We're at 89.8% for our measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and that's the one that you need to have when you're going to school. Now, I honor people if they have a religious exemption. I am not a mandate person, but I am strongly encouraging everyone as a physician to get vaccinated. The exemption rate is about half of the people that don't get it. That's 5.3%. So the other 5% would get us there. They just haven't made their appointments with their pediatrician. So I really press everyone to do that. And though we're 89.8% and we're surviving, there are some schools that are 60%. And they will see terrible outbreaks if we are unlucky enough to import a case of measles from some other region, some other country. Our last outbreak occurred with just two cases. It was a traveler from, I think it was from in the Australia area. And stuff happens, of course, so we'll support people. But remember, one out of five people that catch measles end up in the hospital, and one out of 500 people that catch measles die. So it's a totally preventable disease, and that's what I'm telling people. Just let's prevent the stuff we can prevent, because there's some things that are outside of our power.
And we did see stories about how the measles count is the highest it's been since we thought we eradicated the disease. But also on the COVID front, I understand we've got a little bit of a surge based on the wastewater viral load. And I'm told by the health department that they are revamping the COVID dashboard, because we haven't seen hospitalization numbers get updated in about a month or so. But I don't know, is that just something that the state is doing internally, or is that a mandate that's coming down from the feds about what's being put out there for COVID numbers?
Look, I've instructed our Department of Health to be absolutely transparent always, irrespective of how the federal government has chosen to walk away from that kind of reporting. So we're going to do it. Now, next week, I've been asked to go to Colorado to talk with all the governors in the Governor Association meeting, and I will be meeting with Dr. Oz. And actually, RFK, believe it or not, has reached out to ask if we could sit down and talk a little bit. And I'm going to emphasize my belief that vaccine programs have to be supported without question. And that might be quite the interesting conversation. At the same time, there's always an opportunity to try to work together with people, and I'll be doing that. I can split the difference with people that have differences in ideology. For instance, we're going to fight for vaccinations, and that's the point of your question, and COVID has to be dealt with. If people feel sick, they should get a COVID test from their doctor. But at the same time, there are these chronic diseases that we have to fight, and in that sense, I do think that the Department of Health and Human Services is on the right track to deal with chronic disease and deal with processed foods. There's a lot of health issues out there. One of the things that people should know is we have to fight to keep our Medicaid benefits together. But at the same time, I have been negotiating a very large amount of resource to come to Hawaii, well over $100 million, maybe over $200 million a year, so that we can fortify our rural health system and get these vaccinations for people and get doctors to do the COVID test. It's all a part of a larger need to have a good public health system. And that's always going to be a priority for me as a physician governor.
And are we going to be able to meet the compliance on keeping our error rates low for the SNAP program? Because we did get that fine. And I understand we did get a bit of a break if we could modernize our system so that we could get better accounting out there and not have so many overpayments. But the penalties, I understand, could be even worse based on the language that just got passed.
Yes. So a great deal of credit is due to Director Yamane. Ryan's done a very good job. They got their error rates way down already. They're down to 6.6%, which is quickly getting down to the floor of what the standard or expectation is. 6% is the expectation to have no penalty whatsoever. And I'm really happy about that. Anything that low is going to result in only a 5% penalty on SNAP benefits. And I think we will get under the 6% threshold by the time we have to do it. I'm going to be fighting to protect food programs. Jamie, First Lady, is a big advocate on universal access to school lunches and nutrition for all children. So that's a part of our five-year plan, honestly. We're in year two right now funding some of this stuff, and thankful to the legislature, especially the chairs who fought for that. So there's good work being done there, but we can't afford to lose our SNAP program. I think it's about $700 million, and therefore a 5% penalty is real money, so $35 million. We are going to do that. They did make some changes so that our admin costs go up. We're going to fund that. It's an extra $13 million. But just so everyone knows, our budget is pretty solid. We were able to negotiate the settlement of the pharmaceutical case. That brought us $555 million. The cuts to Medicaid have been put off at least until after this two-year cycle, which was something I fought for. And we're going to navigate any big changes in our budget so that we can keep working on the things we really care about, which is housing for everybody, healthcare for everyone, and food security. These are the fundamental issues that I think people bring up to me day after day. There are, of course, a lot of issues out there, but affordability is key. And one thing that people haven't talked a lot about in affordability is energy costs. That's another thing we're working pretty diligently on, but it's going to take time. The big picture is we're doing very well as a state, and we may even do, ironically, better for a short time because the cuts are put off a little bit, but they're disconcerting. And I am disappointed that the federal government decided to emphasize tax breaks for wealthy people instead of security for all people. But we can debate that at a different time. Right now, I'm just trying to make sure that we keep it together in Hawaii.
That was part of a conversation we had with Governor Josh Green, who we talked to earlier this morning. You know, we've had marketing on our minds in recent weeks with the Hawaii Tourism Authority in the headlines. And today we spotlight a woman who has been honored with a Global Marketing Award for distinguished service. Her feet are planted deep in Waikiki. Sam Shankus arrived on the island decades ago to take a job marketing the Ala Moana Shopping Center. She recently accepted the Distinguished Service Award from the International Council of Shopping Centers, a global trade association which was founded in 1957. Here's Shankus explaining what this award means to her.
Our organization is international. I think there's something like 70,000 members, and they only recognize 3 or 4 people a year. So 150 people have won the award since 1987. 33 of those people were international from other countries, and I am the first person from Hawaii to ever win the award. So it's very thrilling.
Your heart is here in Waikiki for as long as I've known you. You've been into marketing Hawaii with your work with the Hawaii Visitors Bureau and the Hawaii Tourism Authority. You are here at the Royal Hawaiian, and it really is the centerpiece of Waikiki.
Oh, the Royal Hawaiian Center, there's a term in Hawaiian where you're the piko. And Royal Hawaiian Center, this is Kamehameha School's land. Helamoa is the official name for this place. So it's very important that you balance a couple of things. The reality is it's 2025 as a shopping complex. You also have to offer not just the commerce of shopping and dining. You need to provide a beautiful place, a destination. We have over 100 coconut trees on the property. We have a statue of Princess Pauahi reading to a child in the Royal Grove because it is Helamoa. We have free Hawaiian cultural classes daily every week. You can learn to dance hula. You can make a flower lei. You can learn how to play a ukulele, lauhala weaving. We have entertainment in the Grove. We do a lot to celebrate and welcome you to enjoy the culture of Hawaii. And you can have a great dinner at Wolfgang Steakhouse, and you can shop, and you can do a lot of things. We're very focused on our kama'aina. We have a fabulous parking program. Spend some money. You get your parking validated. If you have your ID with you, you bring your receipt to our Hele Mohale guest services. Show your ID, show your receipt. We'll give you 3 free hours of parking. Now, some people say, well, Sam, why do I have to spend any money? Because we're in Waikiki. Now, think about it. If parking here were free, you would pull up, and the parking structure would be filled because guess what? Everybody would have a surfboard rack on the top of their car. Surfing. I've heard that the beaches in Waikiki are pretty spectacular. So imagine free parking in Waikiki. You'd never get in. So that's one of the key reasons that you have to control the parking because Waikiki is a fabulous place.
We saw during COVID some unusual things. You know, Mayor Caldwell shut Kalakaua down and invited people to come roller skate and ride bike. And it was once in a lifetime thing because that would be too hard to do right now given the commerce of Waikiki. Uh-huh. But you also did some things to bring the community down during COVID when we were shut down.
Yeah. When I won the award, one of the questions was, what is something that you feel you did that was very important to you? And we as a team, as we were coming out of COVID, we wanted to bring joy to children. The coming out of COVID, it was gonna be Halloween. We normally have the biggest costume contest on the island. We have great prizes, it's a lot of fun. We have over 400 costumes every year. So for that first Halloween, we dressed up characters and we had them on Royal Hawaiian Avenue, and it was a drive-by to just let children have a little bit of fun. We thought maybe 100 cars, but let's do it. Traffic was backed up to Ala Moana Boulevard, and we had to have HPD help direct the traffic. But there were children in those cars dressed up, waving, happy. We had about 20 characters on both sides of Royal Hawaiian Avenue, and it was joyful, and it was a little moment. For Christmas, what do? Santa is coming, right? You can't tell a child, oh, it's COVID. Santa's not coming this year. You can't do that. So we put Santa and Mrs. Claus in a snow globe, and we put them in an interior area of the center. And then you could come, bring your own phone, plenty of sanitizer all the way around, and we would take your photo of you with your child with your phone, and your child saw Santa and Mrs. Claus. So they had that window of normalcy, because when you're a child, Santa's a big deal. Halloween is a big deal. And it was up to us to figure out how can we get that joy to the cakey.
So those kinds of things are what this award is all about.
That, yeah. And I think another thing the award is about, I was figuring out, I came to Hawaii in 1984, and I had the opportunity to come as the marketing director of Ala Moana. And one of the challenges was that everybody knew me. One of the opportunities was that everybody felt that I could help them. I have been on many boards over the years. And to me, I really enjoy being on the boards, serving the community. And it's a broad array. And I've supported tourism for as long as I've been here. I've been active with tourism boards. I'm still on the Waikiki Improvement Association board, Hawaii Hotel Lodging Association, I'm on that. I've been in Rotary for 35 years. I was the chair of the Hawaii Dental Service for 10 years because they approached me and said, Sam, we have a diverse board and we'd really appreciate you joining the team. Salvation Army, I've been on the Salvation Army Advisory Board of Honolulu for, I think it's 23 years. I am somebody that finds joy in helping.
Yeah, but you're reaching out throughout the community,
yeah,
and showcasing, I guess, the aloha spirit, really.
Yeah.
It's what we do.
Yeah, oh, aloha festivals. I've been involved with aloha festivals. I was president way, way back in the day when it was statewide back in 93. And then I have been co-chairing the board with Debbie Nakanilua Richards from Hawaiian Airlines for, I think we're going on our 12th year. So it's really important that you perpetuate and celebrate the culture, because the culture is with us. The Princess Pauahi statue, it's a beautiful statue, but it's a statue. It's up to us to perpetuate that and share who she was as people.
Because of your time here in Waikiki, on this island, uh-huh, in the state, from where you sit, uh-huh, and given the situation with the HTA and how it's being transformed, any thoughts about what's happening with the HTA and where we go from here?
I think it's critical that we all get in the same canoe. There seems to be a lot of different goals. You have goals that are financial. You have goals that are protectionist. You have goals that, for lack of a better word, driven by fear. What's going on? How can we make a difference? How can we help? That never worked. And I think the aloha spirit, I think sometimes there's an attitude that if you're for tourism, you're not for anything else. Tourism is part of the fabric of Hawaii. So maybe there's degrees of interest or degrees of activity, but we all are ambassadors of where we live. I remember Duke Kahanamoku. Duke Kahanamoku, he always was proud of who he was and where he lived. So it's like we are ambassadors. So for tourism now, it seems like we're losing a common goal, common vision. I understand you've got hotels and you've got transportation, you have airlines, you've got all of these different players. but we all want the same thing. We want you, we want anybody who comes to Hawaii to enjoy it, to feel welcome, to feel the aloha spirit, and to want to come back. We all want that. So maybe it's just figuring out how to get everybody to, number one, come to an agreement what our priorities are, what is critical to accomplish, what we can put off a little while, but to get in the same canoe. That sounds really basic, but I really think that's critical.
Yeah, and pull in the same direction.
Yeah, well, that means looking in the same direction.
Thank you, Sam, for sharing your mana'o, and congratulations on your role.
Thank you. It is so wonderful to spend time with you. I mean, how long have we known each other? Oh, mahalo. Mahalo nui.
And that was Sam Shankus of the Hawaiian Shopping Center, who was recently honored with the International Council of Shopping Centers Award for Distinguished Service to her community. Shankus is the first from Hawaii to get the award.
I'm Anita Rao. There is a high chance that what you think you know about bisexuality is wrong.
The word doesn't mean like a 50-50 split. It doesn't mean what a lot of people think it has to mean. There's not like a litmus test.
Stories of bisexuality beyond the binary. Join us next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Congress established public media in the 1960s. Now, it's voted to cut funding to it. Hawaii Public Radio will continue to be here for you, but in a weakened financial position, we'll need your help. With more local support, we can go from 94% community supported to 100%. Let's make it happen. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org and click donate.
Some summer programs across the state were at risk of being canceled due to funding cuts, but today we spotlight one summer intensive that did get underway. HBR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel checked in with organizers and participants of a STEM program that expanded to Maui last year. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, and you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, all important stuff.
Absolutely. So students, about 300 middle schoolers from across the state, are wrapping up a three-week intensive technology education camp. And it's a partnership between University of Hawaii and a nationwide Verizon program called the Verizon Innovative Learning STEM Achievers Program. A little bit of a mouthful. But there are 45 sites across the country, and Hawaii is one of those. It started here in 2021, and it's now almost all the way across the state. Maui was added last year. And this year it extended to West Maui students. So they had a bus program that brought students from the Lahaina area to the Maui College campus. And it's an opportunity that's free of charge to students. It includes the meals, all the supplies, equipment, all provided through Verizon. And students took four technology tracks over the 3 weeks. They looked at artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printing, coding, augmented reality, and virtual reality, all exploring these different topics, and then they chose an area to focus on for their final project. The Maui students just had their showcase last night, or yesterday afternoon, I should say. And I spoke with Dirk Soma, who is a professor at Kauai Community College, and he's also the Hawaii director for the Verizon program. So we talked about adapting this national program for Hawaii students to include cultural themes.
On Oahu this year, for example, they're taking a voyaging theme. So they are doing design challenges around Hokulea and navigation. They've used the 3D printing to create Hawaiian star maps, and they are doing augmented and virtual reality using Moana as a theme and creating various scenarios using that. On Maui, they've incorporated Hawaiian culture from start to end of the program. Each day begins with an oli. And then for their 3D printing, they have started making ohe kapala, which are the bamboo printing sticks that are used to print the designs on kapa traditionally. Now they're using plastics through 3D printing to create those. They are also using the drone technologies and the spheros, which are our rovers, to conduct soil samples so they can use it in case of emergency preparedness and these kinds of things in relation to, you know, what's happened in Lahaina with the Lahaina fires. I'm really happy that this year our Maui program has expanded. Last year they did 75 students. This year they're doing 150. And they've reached out to the West Side community, and they actually have students and mentors and instructors from the West Side as part of the program.
That's great that they're, you know, doing the real world problems, but also that cultural touch too. Very nice.
Yeah, it's a nice combination of those two. They're also talking about responsible uses of technology. You know, in today's age, we hear so much about kind of the scary parts of technology. And so they talked a lot about how to use those in a way that is productive in today's society, family involvement in that discussion as well. The Maui program, as I said, just had their showcase yesterday, and it's amazing to hear what these kids are creating. One Lahaina student that I spoke with, who goes to Lahaina Intermediate, she used virtual reality to recreate the Baldwin home on Front Street that burned in the fire. And she wants to raise money to rebuild it and help people get that experience of virtually walking through it as it was before the fire, and help people get to experience it even though they aren't able to do that anymore. Leimana Pu'u is a Hawaiian immersion language immersion educator at Ke Kula Opi'i Lani in Wailuku, and she shared more about some of these final projects and what the students explored.
We have one group that chose a community-based problem of plastics and pollution at our beaches. So they've designed and created handheld microplastic filters that can be used at the beach, which I thought was super amazing and super awesome, and I think they really have a good idea going on with their project. Another group really enjoyed the rovers, and I think that's one thing that was super awesome to see the students do over the past 3 weeks, is watching them use from the four different classes, watching them bringing it together to tackle one community-based problem. And so they really love the rovers class, so they've been using the 3D printers to print out some attachments and re-envision the types of services that rovers and helpful robots can do for us and in our community to address short staffing in certain areas. And so they have big dreams, which is always good for our youth. And so I'm hoping that from the 3 weeks that it only fed to the dreams that they have already existing and uplift them in the years to come.
Well, what a great story. But thank you so much, Catherine, for showcasing this.
Thanks so much.
We have been hearing from Catherine Kluwet-Patel, who had a feature about a STEM program on Maui. This year, Kenny Endo marks 5 decades as a taiko drum master. We caught up with him last week at a rehearsal for 2 upcoming taiko concerts in August to help celebrate the Mind Snow. He reflected on those early days when he got bit by the taiko bug.
I've been playing drums since I was a kid. I actually started playing Western drums. So I played percussion in band and later started playing drum set when I was in junior high school, and played in rock bands, and later got into jazz and funk and Latin music. So I really didn't start playing taiko until I was in college. At that time, there are a lot of college groups now, but at that time there was no college groups, but there was a community group, one of the first groups in the United States, called Kinara Taiko from Los Angeles. They were based out of a Buddhist temple called Senshin in LA. They were only practicing during the summer Obon season, so they introduced me to the San Francisco Taiko Dojo. There was actually a teacher there from Japan, Tanaka Sensei. When I graduated from college, I moved up to San Francisco to study with Tanaka Sensei kind of full time and stayed with him for about 5 years, and then decided I wanted to really learn the basis or the roots of this art form. So I moved to Japan in 1980, intending to stay for a year, and I ended up staying 10 years there.
So you really immersed yourself in this?
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, the more you study, the more you realize how little you know. Even 10 years wasn't enough, but it was a good time to be there, the 80s. Japan was thriving and the economy was going well. There was a lot of money for the arts, so there was a lot of opportunities to perform. The actual dojo at that time was in Japantown in San Francisco. The actual practice was twice a week, but I was given a key to the dojo, so I practiced almost every day. And then I also got a job playing in a nightclub in a band. So I was doing that at night and doing taiko also. It was a good 5 years in San Francisco.
Gosh, what is it about taiko that just grabs you?
One of the things I remember about hearing taiko for the first time was the sound. It has a very deep sound. It penetrates your whole body. You can feel it down to your bones practically. And so it's not just with your ears. You're experiencing it with your whole body. So that was one of the things. The first time I saw a group playing taiko was when I was a student at UC Santa Cruz, and they were playing in San Jose, but it was the San Francisco Taiko Dojo, and I was just blown away. I had no idea this existed and was part of my cultural heritage, but I didn't know anything about it, but I immediately became hooked. Yeah, it's very physical. They're all different size drums. There's very small ones, there's big ones, there's huge ones. In the concert we're doing in August, we'll be using the largest one that I have, which is about, the skin surface is about 3 feet in diameter. And then we'll be using some very small ones also. On the first day, August 9th, we'll be doing some classical music. And when we talk about classical music in using drums, we're pretty much talking about the theater forms such as no and kabuki. And so we'll be doing some music from kabuki. There's 8 people from Japan coming, including a couple of my teachers. As much of a celebration of being 50 years of playing taiko, I really want to introduce my teachers to the people of Hawaii. In the second half, I'm going to be collaborating with local musicians, jazz musicians, classical musicians, martial artists, and introduce people to those world-class type of artistry that exists here in Hawaii. On the second day, we're going to feature our Taiko Center of the Pacific ensembles, both our youth group and our adults group. And many of them have written pieces that will be premiered that night. So that's exciting. So it's like bringing the past and the future together.
And, you know, you rehearse here at Washington Intermediate, you know, and you have classes that you also teach?
Yes, we have public classes. We teach from the age of 2, and we have people in their 80s taking classes. So part of our philosophy is that it's never too early, it's never too late.
And then as far as the instruments, I don't know, is there something that maybe you would like to share with listeners about how those drums are made?
Most of the performance drums we'll be using in our concerts come from Japan. And there's a very famous maker there by the name of Miyamoto Unosuke, who are based in Tokyo, an area called Asakusa. And they make some of the finest sounding and looking taiko in the world. And I'm very lucky that they've been a supporter of mine, and much of our equipment comes from them. In our classes and in our rehearsals, we use taiko that we made ourselves out of wine barrels. So we keep our performance drums, we keep them separate from our drums we use in our classes and our rehearsals.
I've seen some drums that are in Japan that are huge, right? They're like huge trunks of trees, which they're massive.
Yeah, traditionally they're carved out of a single tree trunk, and the tree is called keaki, and it's actually a becoming an endangered species now, but there are many of the taiko makers have farms where they actually grow the keaki. But like the drum that I'm going to be using on August 9th and 10th, that's one solid piece of wood, and they say that the tree would have had to been at least 300 years old to get a tree that make a drum that big. So most of the drums are made from a single piece of wood like that.
Anything else about the concert that you think might appeal to people and the different activities that you've got planned?
August 9th is going to be a combination of traditional music and contemporary music, but all using taiko. The August 10th concert is going to also feature all these drums with more of our young people and our adults also who have composed pieces and introducing that art form we call kumidaiko or ensemble drumming. We're actually going to follow that weekend with 3 days of workshops, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at the University of Hawaii Music Department. We're going to be doing workshops by our guests from Japan as well as some from the mainland. We have about 8 to 10 instructors doing workshops, including the main ones from Japan.
So these would be like what, master classes then, huh?
Yeah. They're open to the public as well. And then the evening of that week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we're going to offer lecture demonstrations, one featuring Saburo Mochizuki, who is my teacher that teaches the classical music. And then the Wednesday lecture demonstration will feature Kyosuke Suzuki, who is a master of the lion dance and Tokyo Festival music. And then I will be giving a lecture demonstration on Thursday evening. These are all free, by the way, and the topic will be how the tradition has influenced my contemporary compositions. And then the last thing that we're doing is Friday evening, we're showing a film at the Honolulu Art Museum called Healing Beats by a Spanish filmmaker named Ivan Munoz. He came out with this film about 5 years ago, but it hasn't been shown in the United States. It's actually a U.S. premiere of this film. He really made a fantastic film, interviewed people in Japan, in the United States, in Europe, and I wish he could actually come, but he's based in Madrid, so we'll be showing that. And then I have a tour, both in the islands in September and on the mainland in October and November. It'll be a tour of my contemporary ensemble, about 5 or 6 people. So not only taiko, but instruments such as vibraphone, ukulele, string instruments.
Okay, so your band is going on the road.
Yeah. We have about 10 concerts that we're going to be doing. Mainly in the Midwest, Ohio, and then in Colorado, and then on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and California. And hopefully, my booking agent is working on something for the East Coast for the spring of 26.
You're going to be a busy man. Yeah, any signs of slowing down after 50 years?
Yeah, actually, we're my wife and Chizuko and I started this school, and we're about ready to hand off the school to younger people and to ensure that it keeps going. I'm not retiring, but it's time to turn certain things over to responsible people.
And I don't know if it's fair for me to ask, but I don't know, do you have a favorite drum? Tough, yeah. It's like asking your favorite child.
It is tough. Starting from the small one, there's a hand drum called a kotsuzumi, which I'll be playing on Saturday, which I really love the sound. It's the only drum that we don't use a stick. We use our bare hand. It has a beautiful sound. I have also created a taiko set, a set of 3 different drums, a low, medium, and high pitch drum that I use for my contemporary music. And of course, the large drum, the odaiko. I love this odaiko that I have here. It sounds beautiful, but it looks beautiful as well.
Yeah, it's seasoned, huh?
Yeah, there's a lot of energy and spirit, a lot of mana in the instruments.
I don't know, anything else that you want to convey to people about your love for taiko?
Well, I'd like to thank the people of Hawaii for being such great supporters of this art form and just of the performing arts in general. But I've received a lot of support from people, not only our performing members, but the people in the community, the people who take classes. My wife and I really have a lot of gratitude toward the people here in Hawaii who have supported us and given us friendship for many years.
I often hear that there are so many traditions that are so strong here in Hawaii, even maybe not so strong in Japan. I think it's just the people's love, I guess, for this maybe art form.
Yeah, in fact, I think there's something like 25 taiko groups in the state of Hawaii right now, and half of them are on Oahu. But it's pretty amazing how it's grown. There was only 3 taiko groups when I first started playing in 1975, 3 taiko groups outside of Japan, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Jose, all in California. But now there's close to 400 groups in the U.S., North America. In Brazil, in the state of Sao Paulo, there's over 100 groups. There's groups in Australia, Southeast Asia. Europe has over 100 groups. It's pretty amazing how it's becoming an instrument that people love. And we always encourage them to learn as much about the tradition as possible, but it's becoming an instrument like a guitar or a piano. It's evolving so that a lot of different kind of music is going to come out of that, and it's exciting to see.
That was Kenny Endo, Taiko Master, talking about 2 upcoming concerts at the University of Hawaii at Manoa next month. Look for links on our website for more info about those performances and the Taiko workshops.
On the next Science Friday, we're climbing into the submersible Alvin to explore the deep sea. But things don't go as planned.
Both legs of that ground just dropped at the same time. I don't know, should I be concerned about that?
What would you do if your sub broke at the bottom of the sea? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to talk about the rule of law, why the Senate's holding forums to help us navigate through these tumultuous political times. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Manny Bender, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and our digital team. Our intern is Laura Dukes. Thanks to John DeMello for our backyard quiz intro and our theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 8. And if you missed the headlines at the top of the hour, Congress has zeroed out the budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and HBR will be affected. We are holding a mini pledge drive next week on Wednesday and Thursday. And if you're not yet a supporting member, we invite you to join us then. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.